Okay. How are you?
Okay.
I'll try to.
Okay. The next case is number 09-1239, Crash Dummy against Mattel. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Theodore Davis. I represent the appellant in this matter, Crash Dummy Movie LLC, which is referred to in the party's briefs as CDM. This appeal arises from a Trademark Trial and Appeal Board decision sustaining an opposition to CDM's application to register the Crash Dummies trademark for a line of toys and playthings. The basis for the board's decision is the claim rights of the appellee Mattel to the same mark. Your Honors, the parties agree on a number of material facts underlying this appeal. They agree, for example, that for purposes of this proceeding, that their marks are likely to be confused. They agree that CDM's claimed date of priority is March 31st, 2003, the filing date of its application. And they agree that Mattel's claimed rights date back to 1991, which is the date of first use of a predecessor, Tyco. And finally, Mattel does not challenge the board's finding in this case of a prima facie showing of abandonment based on 3 years' worth of non-use of the mark in question. The parties disagree, however, on whether Mattel successfully rebutted the presumption of abandonment arising from that 3 years' worth of non-use. And the board's conclusion that Mattel did rebut that presumption is grounded in three errors that warrant reversal or, at a minimum, a remand in this case. First, the board erred as a matter of law in its application of the prima facie presumption of abandonment under Section 45 by considering evidence and testimony post-dating the third anniversary of the discontinuance of the marks in question. Second, the board erred as a matter of law in conflating the two tests for abandonment found in Section 45 by considering testimony and evidence of residual goodwill in the inquiry as to whether abandonment had occurred as a result of non-use. And then finally, under a proper application of Section 45, the board erred in finding that the presumption of abandonment in this particular case had been successfully rebutted.
Can you, before you get into the meat of your argument, can you help me out by making sure I understand the pertinent dates here that at least you feel are the key dates for us to keep in mind? You mentioned, I think, in your brief, December 31st, 1996, as the last date of use. Is that the position you want us to adopt as the outside time for use by Tyco? And
if your honor refers to, I believe it's page A13 of the board's decision. The board made a series of factual findings as to when the mark was used last and when there was an intent to resume use. The last date on which the board might have found there was either actual use or an intent to resume use is 1996. That's the last year referred to in the board's opinion. For purposes of this appeal, we are willing to accept December 31st of that year.
All right.
As the last.
So that's the starting point for the 3 years, as far as you're concerned.
Your Honor, I think that's the only conclusion based on the board's findings of fact.
Right. Well, I'm just trying to get your position. So the answer is yes, that's the starting point.
Yes, that's
and
correct,
the
Your Honor.
Ending point is 2004. Is that when we all agree that there was activity by Mattel that would constitute an actual use again?
I think Mattel would characterize it as the end of 2003, but that distinction is not relevant to
All right,
the issues.
So end of 2003, beginning of 2004.
Yes, Your
Honor. All right. That's correct. I just want to know, I wanted to understand what is, if the parties, if there's any disagreement on that, because the various dates that get thrown around, December 31st, 1995, 94, and so forth, licensees of Tyco and so forth, but you're saying you're willing to live with December 31st, 1996. For purposes of our analysis of this case, as the last day of use.
Your Honor, the last date referred to in the board's opinion is 1996. For purposes of this appeal, yes, we're willing to live with December 31st of that year.
We've hit that. 1998, in the middle of your concern, we have extensive negotiations over this mark. Why isn't that significant with
Your
KB?
Honor, Your Honor, I would disagree with your characterization of extensive negotiations. There are two reasons why that is not a sufficient showing to rebut the prima facie showing of...
Why did the negotiations fail?
Your Honor, there is testimony, but not the evidence, the record evidence required by this Court's decisions in Rivard.
Why does it fail?
Because it is not a cognizable showing under this Court's decisions. There is a requirement that Mattel produce evidence, as with the burden of production is all about. Now, with respect to the testimony, even if testimony is accepted here as a substitute for the evidence required by this Court's decision...
When you say evidence, I mean, testimony is normally regarded as a kind of evidence. Do you mean documentary evidence?
That's exactly what I mean, Your Honor. And that is what the burden of production...
Do you question whether the negotiation happened?
Your Honor, I do, because the...
You don't think it happened at all. You think they're manufacturing this.
I don't know whether it did or not, because the testimony is hearsay in nature.
But you want a letter. In other words, if there was a telephone conversation between KB and Mattel, even if there was a three-hour telephone conversation, that wouldn't be good enough, you think, under the proper standards to constitute evidence of intent to resume? A three-hour telephone conversation versus a one-line letter, you'd say the letter is the only evidence that would be admissible for this purpose?
Your Honor, I have not even seen even testimony.
Well, I understand, but I'm trying to get your position here.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. The burden of production means producing evidence, and that is why this Court refers to evidence. Now,
but again, when you say evidence, remember that courts, as you well know, I mean, when courts say evidence, they sure do include testimony, not just documentary evidence. So you have to be taking the position, as I understand it, that the only kind of evidence that can be considered for purposes of rebutting the presumption of abandonment is documentary evidence, period.
Your Honor, there is no other reading of the burden.
That's your position.
Yes,
the burden. And what case stands for that?
This Court's decision in Imperial Tobacco. And I would refer, Your Honor, to page 1581 of that case, in which this Court observed, in every contested abandonment case, the respondent denies an intention to abandon its mark. Otherwise, there would be no contest, and that's certainly the case here. An averment of no intent to abandon is little more than a denial and a pleading, which is patently insufficient to preclude summary judgment on the ground that the facts are disputed.
Right.
The registrant must put forward evidence.
Evidence. But an averment is merely a position taken pleading or the equivalent thereof. Evidence, such as the example I gave, which is a witness's testimony about a particular event from which, if you believe the witness, one could infer an intent to resume, that would not simply be an averment. It would be in the form of testimonial evidence, but it wouldn't be an averment of intent. Right?
Well, Your Honor,
do you understand the distinction here?
I understand the distinction just
now,
fine.
Why do you say that court's statement about averments applies to the kind of testimonial evidence that I've just described in the hypothetical telephone conversation?
Your Honor, the language treats as equivalent an averment of an intent to resume use and a denial and a pleading. They're one and the same.
Right, but what I'm saying to you, my submission to you is that if I testify about a telephone conversation that occurred back then, and I give you here's what was said between the parties and so forth, from which someone could infer an intent to resume, that's not an averment. That's testimony about an actual event.
Yes, and that is exactly the sort of testimony that was at issue in Imperial Tobacco, in which there was a finding of abandonment as a matter of law.
Here the board accepted it and relied on it, and we're reviewing whether there's substantial evidence to support their decision. Why isn't this part of the evidence?
Your Honor, the answer is twofold. The first is that this was the entirely passive receipt of an overture from a third party.
Well, but of course, we all know that the reason they decline to enter into some agreement is because they intend to use the mark. That's the testimony that we get, and the board relies on. If we accept that evidence is reliable, does that end your case? Because, of course, it falls right in the middle of the period you want to show as abandonment.
It does not, Your Honor, because, again, just the passive receipt of a single offer is not good enough.
Well, that isn't exactly what's happening here. They didn't passively receive it. They denied it, according to their testimony, because they intended to use it.
Yes, Your Honor, and that conduct does not compare favorably to the conduct of the Mark Odom Imperial Tobacco, who affirmatively went out, or the conduct of the mark owner in the 11th Circuit case.
Well, but they explained that, too. They had some, they were acquiring Tyco. There was a period of corporate unrest that delayed some of their plans. But clearly we have in 98 an intent to continue to use.
Your Honor has referred to plans. Those plans are not laid out anywhere in the record. There is, for example, no testimony of a timetable. There's no testimony of a business plan. Even the testimony, even if the court accepts the hearsay testimony in the absence of a record evidence, what are those
plans? So your case really turns on whether we accept that evidence or not.
No, Your Honor, it does not. The court can accept that evidence, but it is not cognizable for the same reasons that the very same argument was not accepted by the commissioner in the New England Mutual Insurance case, which is cited in both of our briefs, and which Mattel's briefs just simply do not address. If you're talking about retooling being the reason...
In February of that year, 1998, PTO submitted a new assignment notice to the PTO saying it now owned the marks. Why doesn't that corroborate a little bit what happens with KB?
Because, Your Honor, the transaction took place in February of 1997. That was what the board found. That was what that submission to which Your Honor refers says. And indeed, on page 7 of Mattel's brief, Mattel acknowledges that the transaction took place in 1997.
But
Your Honor,
we're starting to get a little more evidence that they're not abandoning this.
Your Honor, the nature of the evidence required is evidence of an intent to resume use of the mark, of concrete plans. What Your Honor is referring to is not something that reflects that intent. It is an assignment document of over 340 registrations. It is not evidence of an intent to resume use as to any single one of those registrations.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis. We'll save you rebuttal time. And let's hear from Mr. Rutledge.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. The Board should be affirmed because substantial evidence supports the Board's finding that Mattel did not abandon the crash dummies marks and because the Board did not commit any legal errors. The CDM has attacked the standard of review and indeed the very standard on which the Board made its decision, which was the totality of the circumstances standard. CDM has said that we've made that standard up out of whole cloth. But
Mr. Rutledge, the unusual event here, it seems to me, is that the registration was actually canceled.
Yes.
And therefore, the public, as a publicly known act, seeing that it's been canceled, that use is not resumed within 3 years, isn't there something there which weighs against the equities of all of the equities of the continuing accepting someday we'll use this mark again?
The cancellation of the registration is the only fact of the 16 different factors that the Board looked at that could possibly be argued to support that. If you're going to talk about the balance of the interest between Mattel and between CDM, one has to look at the interests on both sides. With Mattel here, Mattel had acquired the third largest toy company in the world, Tyco, and one of the three principal properties that identified in acquiring Tyco was the Crash Dummies franchise, along with Matchbox Toys and the radio control. There was obviously a very valuable property that had residual goodwill from that $50 million of sales in its first year to a $120 million worldwide franchise.
And no attempt to keep the mark alive. No token use apparently. No refiling with intent to use.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, token use wouldn't be sufficient. And there's a difference between the mark, the common law rights in the mark, which are being asserted here, and the registration. Certainly, Mattel recorded its assignment of those registrations in February of 1998, and that was a signal.
It was 98, not 97, right?
That's correct.
And you can find that at 8338, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so we had several things going on there in 1998, where we also had the proposal from KB Toys, and this is not a case like ITC.
Is there any documentary evidence to corroborate that?
The evidence is solely the testimony of Mr. Frank, and counsel repeatedly said that that testimony was just hearsay. The problem with characterizing that evidence as hearsay is they never objected to Mr. Frank's testimony as hearsay during his testimonial deposition, where that could have been addressed. They never objected to his testimony as hearsay in their trial brief. They never objected to his testimony as hearsay below at all. They waived the hearsay objection. They did, however, object on the basis of competence. The judge overruled that objection, and they've not renewed that competence objection here. So they've waived the competence objection. There is no objection to Mr. Frank's testimony that's properly before this court. And Mr. Frank's testimony about the KB Toys analysis stands unrebutted. And what he testified was that it was not just the mere passive receipt of an unsolicited proposal. What Mattel did is they went back and they looked at these molds that it had acquired 10 months later, after it acquired the marks in February of 1997. It wasn't until 10 months later it acquired the actual business of Tyco. So what it did in 1998 is it went back and it looked at those molds and said, you know what, those molds are not going to do. We've got to have new molds to meet our stringent safety standards. It looked at what the cost of developing those new molds would be, contrasted those new molds with the deal that was proposed by KB Toys. Remember, KB Toys was proposing an exclusive deal with KB Toys, and they said the volume that KB Toys is currently experiencing is not going to be sufficient enough to justify us having to retool that entire line. Because remember,
why was the mark canceled in 99?
I'm sorry, pardon?
Why was the mark canceled in 99?
Because they did not file the Section 8 and 15 affidavits that said that they'd been continuing use. And in fact, they hadn't been continuing use, so they couldn't file those affidavits. So they went ahead in 1998 and did that calculus where they examined that potential use, and it was just 2 short years later, in 2000, they started this process of research and concept approval, and recall Mr. Frank's testimony about the concept approval. Management said, no, you've got to go back to research and expand the line. We want a greater use of the Crash Dummies franchise. So they went back to research, they did the development, they got the management approval to proceed to production and into sales, and they were well along in that process before CDM ever filed its intent to use application. Now remember, CDM filed an intent to use application. They've never used this mark on these products, but CDM has a long history here because CDM had a film option with Tyco where CDM acknowledged that Tyco kept the rights to the toys. And that was the film option that expired in the middle of 1996. Tyco said to CDM, you didn't live up to the agreement, we're not going to renew the option, we are going to find somebody else to do the film option. And so then CDM comes back and files an intent to use application while Mattel is in the middle of this complex process that took it 3 years, yes, but what it did was it expanded the Crash Dummies mark so that it sold almost 2 million units of these Crash Dummies products. And it wasn't just the Crash Dummies figures. They expanded the line to include vehicles, cars, a bus, a launcher to launch these vehicles to simulate the crash. it dramatically invested. So when you're talking about fairness and equity and expectations, this is not a case where there's any warehousing like has been implied in the briefs or hoarding of marks. This is a case that the board found there was a constancy of effort. The board found that there was no abandonment. The board found that there was no intent to abandonment. Those are all factual findings that are supported by substantial evidence in the record.
The board refers at one point to industry recycling practice. What case law supports that as a factor to be considered?
Well, there's case law going both ways on that, it's we're not so much relying on the specific case law that supports that, but on the specific facts of the testimony. Mr. Frank talked about how Mattel, as well as others in the industry, had this long practice of recycling popular toy franchises, and they recognized when they purchased Tyco that it was a phenomenally successful franchise, and it was a phenomenally successful toy pattern. They talked about the play pattern of crashing, and it was something that they went back to just a few short years after that acquisition. So recycling of the toy brands was supported specifically by the testimony of Mr. Walsh and specifically by the testimony of Mr. Frank.
Mr. Davis argues that the Imperial Tobacco case and others stand for the proposition that I hope I don't mischaracterize his position, but documentary evidence is acceptable, but that testimonial evidence of intent is not acceptable to establish non-abandonment.
That's flat out wrong. That Imperial Tobacco, the court noted, it was a mere averment case. What we have here is not a mere averment of an intent to resume use. What we have is unchallenged testimony about facts or circumstances, as the statute says, from which Mattel's intent not to abandon can be inferred.
So do you have anything besides Dr. Frank in the period from 96 to 99?
Absolutely. We have Mattel went in and recorded the assignments of those marks. And
Did it record the assignment of all of the marks it obtained from Tyco globally?
Yes.
As opposed to saying, here are 3, 6, 9, 12 marks that we want to preserve?
Yes, it did.
So they just took their entire package of marks and recorded them.
Correct.
All right, well, that's correct. All right, that may not be terribly probative of what they intended to do with respect to a particular subset of the entire group of marks, right?
But it is some evidence, and the board looked at, as I said before, 16 different factors. It looked at really all of the circumstances.
Okay, but I was interested in your answer to Judge Rader's question as well. So if I interrupted. So you said there's the other than the Mr. or Dr. Frank, there's the registration. What else?
Well, then there's the KB Toys.
Yeah, but that's only
analysis.
That's only in Frank. Right, we only have that
correct
through him.
And but it's uncontradicted.
Well, okay. All right.
And at that point, then we skip forward to 2000, where we have the ideation research, the concept approval, more research.
And the only evidence of that, again, is Dr. Frank, right?
Correct.
And
correct.
Then we have
the the uncontradicted testimony of Mr. Frank.
Right. Is it Mr. or Dr.?
Mr. He's the marketing manager for these particular products, so it's Mr.
Right.
Frank. And like I said, his evidence was not contradicted, and it was not objected to below. So Imperial Tobacco does not render that a mere averment. It is testimony of circumstances from which Mattel's intent can be inferred. Imperial Tobacco is important for one other reason, that the court shouldn't just focus arbitrarily on any three-year period. What it should do is it should look at the entire period of non-use and any other circumstances before or after that period of non-use that would suggest that Mattel had this intent. And a classic example is residual goodwill. Based on facts that happened before the period of good use, there was residual goodwill that was recognized by this court in the Cerveceria case in footnote 2, that residual goodwill can be a strong motive to resume use of the mark, and it can be a circumstance that can be combined with others to support an intent to resume use. But more importantly, going back to Imperial Tobacco, the court said at page 1581 that it would look from the mark owner's evidence with respect to what activities it engaged in during the non-use period or what outside events occurred from which an intent to resume use during the non-use period reasonably may be inferred. Actually, said the court said may reasonably be inferred, but I didn't want to split the verb. So
heavens forbid.
The statement that the court can only look at circumstances during the statutory three-year period is flat out inconsistent both with the statute and with this analysis in the Imperial Tobacco case.
Mr. Rutledge, perhaps it's peripheral, but you keep telling us that there was no objection to this or that. This was a proceeding before the TTAB, and my recollection, unless it's changed, is that the evidence is presented to the board, but it's not a district court proceeding where you raise objections and then argue about admissibility and all the rest of it. The information is presented to the board that weighs it, applies the standards that are appropriate at that level of decision. But you've told us several times this morning or this afternoon that since no objection was raised, we should somehow look at what you have told us was presented in a different way.
Your Honor, the board applies the federal rules of evidence, and you'll see that the board in its...
They don't argue about admissibility, particularly during the course of their proceedings.
That's not correct, Your Honor. If you look at the board's opinion, early on, the board went through and addressed all of the objections that had been raised to both the individual documentary exhibits and to the testimony of the witnesses. And you'll see that it addressed, for example, the objection to the competency of Mr. Frank's testimony and overruled that objection. And you'll also see that there's no discussion in the board's opinion of any objection to Mr. Frank's testimony on hearsay because there was no such objection made. And the board was very careful to point out, and I see my time is expired, and I'll just ask that the board be affirmed.
Let me just ask one further question. You've mentioned now twice competency. I mean, I take it that it may be that the board referred to it as competence, but it really is lack of personal knowledge, right?
That was the objection during the deposition that was raised, competence.
What we normally think of as being encompassed within hearsay.
No, competence is Rule 602. Hearsay is going to be Rule 803.
But what I'm saying is they said lack of... I'm just reading from what the board says. The board says that the objection was based on lack of personal knowledge. And that's overruled. And then the board said, we find both are sufficiently competent. Now, the board may have made a mistake in diction, in calling it competence as opposed to admissibility for personal knowledge. But if it in fact, it was an objection based on lack of personal knowledge, that sounds an awful lot like an objection based on hearsay. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, it might be the case if there was, in fact, a basis for that in the trial brief. But if you look at the trial brief, the only objection that is raised is, in fact, competence. So it wasn't just mere semantic problems with the board. It was the fact that the trial brief raised competence. There was no objection on hearsay during the testimonial deposition. There was no objection based on hearsay in the trial brief. The board didn't feel that it needed to get to address the hearsay objection at all.
Yeah, and this is all deposition testimony, sir.
Yes, that's correct.
Let's hear it.
Oh, that's right. We haven't heard it for about one. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rutledge. Mr. Davis.
Your Honor, to address Imperial Tobacco first, refer the court to page 1582 of the Imperial Tobacco opinion, and it will be apparent from that page that that is not a case about a mere averment of an intent to resume use. There is ample testimony and evidence referred to on that page that distinguishes even that case in which there was abandonment as a matter of law from this case. Also, it is not Imperial Tobacco or Rivard that defines the appropriate period as 3 years. It is this court's decision in Cerveceria. I would refer the court to pages 1027 and 1028, where the court refers to the then two-year period was set forth in section 45 and says, when no evidence of intent to resume is offered for a period of proven use of at least 2 years, then as to those years. Not a reference to the entire length of time in question, but as to those years referred to by section 45. Mattel has referred to a constancy of effort found by the board. The question remains, though, what was that effort? What steps were taken? In an earlier appeal, two earlier arguments, the court referred to 21 pages of fact-finding, 150 pages of findings of fact. Mattel here has referred to 16 factors. Which of those factors relate to its conduct after acquiring these marks? The court will find that there is nothing there if the court looks at the record cites in Mattel's brief. Mattel has represented this court that it could not have filed the declarations of use required by Section 8 to maintain these registrations. That is simply not the case. Mattel could have filed declarations of excusable non-use. That option is open to every registrant if it feels that it cannot make the showing of use required by the statute because of circumstances external to it. But even if Mattel had filed such a document indicating that its retooling costs prevented it from putting this mark into use, that still would have been adequate, and even if this court credits the testimony of Mr. Frank as to that point, that still would have been an inadequate showing under the commissioner's decision in N. Ray New England Mutual Life Insurance, which again, Mattel simply has not addressed. Finally, Mattel has referred to the totality of the circumstances test, not only in its brief, but also in its oral argument here, has accused CDM of accusing Mattel of having fabricated this out of whole cloth. As it has in its reply brief, CDM encourages the court to take a look at that case. And the court will see that that case and the language upon which Mattel relies, rather than the language from this court's decisions, addresses a completely separate issue, and that the test Mattel proposes is not extant even in the Ninth Circuit, and certainly should not be applied here at the expense of this court's own decisions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, I must call to the court's attention, I misspoke. The court asked me whether it was a general or specific...
Would you come forward so we can record what you're saying?
Your Honor, I apologize. I misspoke. The court asked whether it was a general or specific assignment. The court will see from pages A 839 through 840 that the assignment was just directed to the crash dummies, the incredible crash dummies mark.
Okay, thank you. Now, Mr. Rickledge, before you go, we have a question for both of you. We've noticed that there are numerous designations of confidentiality in both briefs. We have no interest in publishing confidential information, but it is difficult to discern for some of the designations what the reasons are. Some, such as sales volume or whatever, are clearer. Can we ask both of you to go through the briefs with a sharp pencil and tell us what needs to be preserved as confidential so that we don't inadvertently somehow publish something else. But again, some of the things which seem to be marked or placed in brackets or whatever are very curious.
Would the court like individual letters or a joint letter from the parties?
Whichever is easier for... I suppose it's easier for us, since you may both have had a hand in each other's briefs, if we receive one combined...
When would the court like that?
Well, without placing an undue burden, a week, 10 days?
A week would be fine.
If you would go through the briefs and just mark them up and remove what's removable so that we can understand where we stand.
Your Honor, the designations are exclusively Mattel's,
we
will
defer
to Mattel.
Well, that should make it easier.
We'll do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good. Thank you both. The case is taken under submission.